From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the expanding war on terror, there is a hot debate in the Bush administration about how best to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Not whether, but how. How many troops would be needed? And after Saddam Hussein is overthrown, who would take his place? In this hour, we're stepping back. Should the United States go to war with Iraq? We begin with news of worsening violence in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. Lee Hockstetter is a reporter with the Washington Post in Jerusalem. I asked him to describe the day's events.
Israel has unleashed its deadliest offensive in 20 years since the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. Thousands of troops are participating, probably well over 150 tanks, armored vehicles. There are F-16 warplanes in the air, helicopter gunships. And, of course, the Palestinians are not exactly sitting on their hands. There was another Palestinian attack today, this time in the very far north of Israel near the Lebanese border. A couple of Palestinian gunmen opened fire on Israeli vehicles traveling on a road. They killed six, including a mother and her daughter, and injured seven.
What is the target or are the targets of this very large Israeli push?
Well, that's a matter of dispute. Certainly one target is the Palestinians themselves. Certainly the Palestinian terrorists, militants, gunmen, but also Palestinian civilians. Since midnight last night, in other words, in the past 24 hours more or less, there have been about 30 Palestinians killed, certainly a fair number of civilian non-combatants among them. Today in the Gaza Strip, for example, I talked to the family of a 54-year-old man who was killed when he walked upstairs to try to close the door leading out to his roof. There were tanks coming down his street. As he got to the door, this elderly man was shot and killed. When his oldest son, who was 36, rushed upstairs to help his father, he was also killed at the same doorway.
Lee Hockstetter, give us a sense of what it means when this number of troops and tanks come into the West Bank and Gaza. What does it look like on the ground? How are they actually proceeding?
The tanks roar in columns of armor, along with armored personnel carriers and armored jeeps and armored bulldozers up main streets. They came into Ramallah, for example, which is the main Palestinian city in the West Bank, from three directions today. And they're a very frightening sight if you're on the receiving end of this. They make a lot of noise. The bulldozers are enormous. They had bulldozers dig huge trenches in some of the roads to try to block any other traffic from getting in or out. That often, and perhaps quite intentionally, breaks the water mains, which sends the broken pipe water flooding all over the place. It's a very, very messy process.
Lee, the word war has been floating around for weeks now, but what is the difference between what's going on tonight and war?
Well, I think it is a kind of war. It's a war that ebbs and flows. It's a war of attrition, certainly. And on certain days, today being probably one of them, it's just a plain old war. If you look at this thing for the last 17 or 18 months, there have been gradually escalating peaks, which are often punctuated by lulls. The current peak, in which we've had something well over 200 people killed just since the beginning of March, is certainly the very worst spike of violence in this part of the world between Arabs and Jews in a generation.
The Palestinians, as you say, have not been passive in response, and they've actually taken quite a toll on Israelis, have they not?
I believe 58, 59 Israelis have been killed since March 1st. That's an extraordinary number. If you consider, for example, that in the years of the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, which ended 2 years ago, in a typical year, 25, maybe 30 Israelis would die in a typical year. Now, just in the last 12 or 13 days, we've had almost 60 Israelis killed, both civilians and soldiers.
In your story today in the Washington Post, you quote Lieutenant General Shaul Mofaz, the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, saying, "In a war of attrition, one cannot blink." In that case, where is this leading?
It has always, for 17 or 18 months, led to intensifying violence. Each side's tactics have led the other side to take acts of reprisal and revenge. This dispute has the aspect of a feud. It's backwards looking, it's revenge, it's vengeful, and the horizon of tomorrow doesn't really have a very clear definition for either side.
Is there a point at which outside forces may be brought into this conflict? It certainly happened historically in Israel. Are there any moves, sounds, signals from Arab neighbors or forces outside the region that there might be an intervention on one side or the other?
If you're referring to some kind of Arab invasion, there's absolutely no sign of that. And, of course, the Arabs are probably not militarily equipped to mount any kind of a serious attack on Israel. And there's absolutely no sign of that in any event. As for some kind of international intervention, it's a longstanding goal of the Palestinians to bring in some kind of international intervention. They see it as something behind which they could establish an independent state and perhaps even borders that would be to their liking. The Israelis, for very much the same reasons, have always and ardently opposed that.
The Sharon government has said they would push back against the infrastructure of terror against the Palestinians until, in effect, it seems they cried uncle. Do you see the Israelis getting near that point with these very large deployments of troops and equipment? Are the Palestinians beginning to waver?
I agree that the Israeli strategy, as enunciated by Prime Minister Sharon quite clearly, is to do just as you suggest, to cause a large number of casualties so that the Palestinians cry uncle, so that they give up on achieving some of their political goals and come to the negotiating table in a much more acquiescent mood. However, there's no sign that that's about to happen. Perhaps it's an Israeli strategy in Sharon's formulation that could take many, many months or years, but certainly from what we can see now, the obvious and immediate results are embitterment, hatred, and cries for yet more revenge.
So on the steep upward curve that this violence is following, where are we headed here? To a kind of shared slaughter? What does it look like to you, Lee? Where is this going?
You know, I'll tell you a sort of personal story. A couple of months ago, a correspondent from another newspaper who was considering coming here and her colleague took me out to dinner, and she asked me that very question. She asked me where this place was heading and if she were to come here as correspondent for her newspaper, what she was likely to see. And I told her that I thought that at least for the foreseeable future, the Middle East was, and I'm going to be flip, going to hell in a handbasket. And I'm afraid that even though that sounds flip, that's more or less what's happened since we had that conversation. And it's hard to predict anything very different from that in the near future.
Lee Hockstetter is a reporter with The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from Jerusalem. The war drums in Washington are pounding loud now as the Bush administration wrestles with the Iraq question. Proponents of invasion argue that simply reinstating arms inspections is unrealistic. The only way to prevent Iraq from using weapons of mass destruction, they say, is to overthrow Saddam Hussein using military force. Is it time for U.S. troops to go back into Iraq? Do you support military action to bring down Saddam Hussein, or is there another way to remove the threat? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from outside Washington is Richard Perle, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1987, and Chairman of the Defense Policy Board, a Pentagon advisory group. Good evening and welcome, Richard Perle.
A pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Richard Perle, why does the U.S. need to remove Saddam Hussein from power? What threat does he pose? We know you're a hawk on this. Why?
Well, we know that he has weapons of mass destruction, including biological weapons, anthrax, for example, but others as well, and chemical weapons. We know that unlike others who possess some of these weapons, he's actually used them and used them against civilian populations as well as in the war with Iran. We know that he is busy working to acquire nuclear weapons and may emerge with nuclear weapons at any moment. And we know he hates the United States and declares that at every opportunity. So the question is, can we afford to leave him in place, continuing to work on nuclear weapons, continuing to refine his other weapons of mass destruction, while hoping that he won't use those weapons against us or distribute weapons of mass destruction to terrorists who might use them against us? And I think we've reached the point where the danger of waiting too long is greater than the risks involved in removing him from office.
How would you assess the risks involved in removing him from office, as you say, regime change, the phrase that's in Washington now? What are the dangers associated with going into Iraq one way or another to take Saddam Hussein out?
Well, of course, it depends very much on how we go about it. My own view is that we should be working closely with the opposition to Saddam Hussein, which is substantial and understandably given the brutal way in which he has ruled for many years. So we should be assisting the opposition, and should have done that a long time ago, in my view, but it's not too late to do it now. And if they organize effectively, as I think they're capable of doing, they will bear the main brunt of any ground action against Saddam, and the role of the United States would be air power, much as we have seen in Afghanistan.
You're describing the how there, but I want to hone in on the attendant risks or dangers involved.
Well, if we do it that way, as I've just described,
yes,
then I think the single most significant risk is that in a desperation move, he will launch weapons of mass destruction in the region, most likely. He has missiles that could potentially deliver such weapons against his neighbors. And I don't think there's any way to reduce that risk to zero, although I think we can reduce it significantly, since he has relatively few such weapons, and our ability to detect them and deal with them is much greater than it ever was.
And what about the risk of turning the Islamic world even more fervently against the United States than it appears to be today? Are we playing into Osama bin Laden's hand somehow here?
No,
is that possible?
I see no reason to expect that. There's no love for Saddam Hussein in the Islamic world. He's the Ba'ath Party is hardly a religious party, on the contrary. So this isn't a question of the Muslim world versus the non-Muslim world, any more than we offended the Muslim world when we went to the rescue of Kuwait, having been invaded by Saddam Hussein.
I want to bring in Jack Beatty, our on-point news analyst. He joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening and welcome.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jack. Jack, you're hearing Richard Pearl say, here's the 1, 2, 3 of why we need to go after Saddam. The war would be fought largely by Iraqi dissidents, and there's not much danger of upsetting the surrounding Arab world. They would be happy to see Saddam Hussein go down.
Well, that doesn't square with what King Abdullah of Jordan is telling Dick Cheney probably right now. He says that our war on Iraq would destabilize the region. There's been a similar warning from the Turkish president, who's our NATO ally and whose assistance we need in Afghanistan and in the war on terror. And then there's the longstanding fear of the Saudis that such a war would inflame their jihadis, threatening their regime. Mr. Pearl mentions the possibility that Saddam would use weapons of mass destruction on his neighbors. One very likely neighbor would be Israel. One grim scenario is that Israel would then retaliate, and we would turn the whole region into a war against the Israelis, Arab-Israeli War III. Add to all that the effect of this on the war on terror. The Washington Post ran a Pentagon paper recently that said that Saddam has put his weapons of mass destruction and his arsenals around mosques, hospitals, schools. Now, imagine watching these things being bombed. Imagine the effect that this is going to have on the consciousness of people throughout the Arab and Muslim world. We have to choose here. Are we fighting a war on terrorism, which inevitably involves questions of mass psychology and hatred, or are we fighting a war against one dictator who can be contained in other ways? So I don't think Mr. Pearl stated the risks as grimly as I think reality suggests they are.
Richard Pearl, we just have a minute before the break, but your response on the surround of risks here.
Well, I think my assessment of the risks is correct, and they're now being overstated. I don't know what your observer thought about the risks of going into Afghanistan, but I went through the debate in 1991 where we talked about the risks in Iraq, and the gloom and doom crowd were wrong. I listened to what people said before Afghanistan. The gloom and doom crowd were wrong. I see no reason to assume the most extreme scenario.
Richard Pearl, please stand by. And Jack Beatty, we're talking about the move to take Saddam Hussein down in Iraq. Is it time to go after Saddam Hussein? Is it time to send the U.S. military into Iraq? Would invasion remove a threat or fuel a greater war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the mounting apprehension of a war on Iraq in Washington. There's a big move afoot, support quite wide now in Washington, to move on Iraq, on Saddam Hussein. Dick Cheney is in the region tonight in Jordan, making the rounds, mustering support or testing the waters on what's going on there. But there's also a move for the U.S. to go ahead, whether or not it has broad support, to use the unilateral option if necessary. We're joined tonight by Richard Perle. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1987. And the question is, would invasion remove a threat or fuel a greater war? Would removing Saddam bring more or less stability to the Middle East, to the world? And is this what you signed up for when the war on terror was launched? We're also joined now by Scott Ritter. He was former chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Scott Ritter.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Scott Ritter, should the United States go guns blazing into Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein, the threat that Richard Perle describes there to the nation and the world?
Well, if Saddam Hussein posed the kind of threat that Mr. Perle has set forth, if Saddam Hussein was somehow connected to the events of September 11th, if Saddam Hussein was a grave and imminent risk to America's national security interests, as he's been purported to be, I would say yes, absolutely. We must take care of the threat. But the problem is, we hear a lot of talk about Saddam's possession of weapons of mass destruction. Mr. Perle said this tonight. He says, we know he possesses biological weapons. We know he possesses chemical weapons. We know he is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. I would say that the evidence actually suggests that we know we've eliminated these programs. We don't know what's transpired in Iraq since 1998, but no one has put forward any evidence to substantiate the rhetoric that has come out justifying this war. We cannot go to war based upon an unknown. We don't know what's going on in Iraq, but I would say that those who say Iraq poses a threat have yet to substantiate this threat in any verifiable fashion beyond mere statement.
Scott Ritter, you wrote yourself within the last month or so that the weapons inspection program that you were a part of dismantled 90% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. But that leaves 10%, and the program ended 3 years ago. Doesn't that suggest that there would have been time for Saddam and his forces to put a weapon of mass destruction program back together?
Well, you have to keep in mind that, you know, we did, and I think my statement or writing was saying that 90 to 95% level of disarmament had been achieved, and I fully acknowledge that there is a 5 to 10% level of Iraq's former programs that are unaccounted for, but we need to focus on that word, unaccounted for. When you review the compendium document put forward by the Special Commission in January of 1999, nowhere in this document, and this is the definitive report on Iraq's disarmament, nowhere in this document does the weapons inspection program state Iraq has retained prohibited capability. There is significant discussion about the inability of the inspectors to verify Iraqi statements, but there is no evidence that Iraq retained. And you combine this with the fact that since 1994, weapons inspectors operated in Iraq in a monitoring function. That is, we monitored hundreds of Iraq's most advanced industrial sites 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with no notice inspections. And during these monitoring inspections, never once did we detect either a retention of prohibited capability or any evidence that Iraq was reconstituting capability. So inspections did work. There is a concern, and we need to get inspectors back in, but we cannot go to war merely because we think Saddam has done something. We better show that he has done something and then take action.
But Scott Ritter, you acknowledge that there could be a threat there, and after September 11th, we know how disastrously even crude weapons can be deployed, let alone weapons of mass destruction. Would a renewed inspection regime in Iraq be sufficient to give the kind of confidence that the United States now needs that it cannot be the target of an Iraqi attack or Iraqi attack through secondary hands, through terrorist hands?
Well, there's a couple things that have to take place here. One is you need a full understanding of the capabilities that Iraq possessed in 1991. And anybody, and I say again, anybody who thinks they can make a case that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, as they existed in 1991, represented a credible threat to anybody. It's ludicrous. Their biological weapons were inept. The only way they would kill you, we joked as inspectors, if they landed on your head.
Same
with their chemical. But now, let's talk about the inspection process. Three kinds of inspections. Inspections of discovery, that is, finding the weapons. We did very well, but it was incomplete. Now we had the ability of looking for, I'd say, forensic evidence of retained capability. That is through sampling, et cetera. We used some of the most advanced sensor technology available in the world, and we never detected any evidence of retained capability. So this sort of added a salve to assuage the fears and concerns that might arise from the unverifiable accounting issues we had. And the final one, of course, is my monitoring inspections. Iraq never interfered with these inspections, and we were able to ascertain that Iraq was not reconstituting. So if you get those inspections back in, I think we can go very far in terms of, you know, putting together a program that would show that Iraq is not, or at least provide significant deterrence to Iraq's potential reconstitution.
Scott Ritter, stand by. I want to bring Richard Pearl back in. Richard Pearl, Scott Ritter says we don't even have evidence that there's a threat. We'd be going to war on a whim.
Well, I think he's wrong. He certainly takes a view inconsistent with that of his old boss, Richard Butler, who has been categoric on this subject. And if I have to choose between two opinions, I'm going to go with Richard Butler's opinion on this. But there's a larger problem. We don't know what we don't know. We know that Saddam has put tremendous energy into his programs, and we know that he pays a terrible price to keep the inspectors out. And it is not unreasonable to assume, in sanctions, yes, and in his pariah status, it is not unreasonable to assume that he has something important to hide. With respect to the nuclear program, we have evidence from a man who once ran that program about the extent and the nature of it. And Scott Ritter is not going to tell me that the several hundred installations that Qadir Hamza refers to have all been unearthed. I don't think any of them have been unearthed. So I just think we are taking a very substantial risk with this rosy view that Saddam doesn't pose a threat. This is a man who has used weapons of mass destruction in the past. And to say they're not significant when we have all seen the pictures of women and children in a Kurdish village is, understate to an irresponsible degree the danger that Saddam poses.
Jack Beatty, this is a terrible range of realities from we must go in to we must not go in because the threat isn't even there for Americans to try and process as they try and decide whether or not this is an effort to support.
Yeah, we need a debate about this, quite comparable to the one we had in 1990-91 about the original Iraq mission. Mr. Pearl mentions the atrocities committed by Iraq against its own people and against Iran, the use of poison gas. Well, of course, that happened even before 1990, and that didn't stop Senator Bob Dole, quite properly, going over there in the summer of 1990 and trying to make a deal for wheat with Saddam. The point is that there's another way to think about this, and that is these sanctions are a terrible wound for certainly the Iraqi people, but they're also a terrible wound for the United States. We've heard again and again on this program how the sanctions are one of the main irritants in the U.S. communication with the Muslim world.
You mean their impact on the Iraqi civilians?
Their impact on it. And, you know, the thought of saying to Saddam, all right, you want this? We'll take the sanctions off, but you accept inspectors as a way of life. You can join. You can. We'll trade with you, and we'll give you Britney Spears around the clock. But we're also going to install 24/7 inspectors. So it's a deal. And by the way, while we're making this deal, you sign up with Abdullah's Israeli statement too about possible backing of that plan, and we'll do a deal. This was, you know, we were trading with this man. We still buy his oil. And we were trading with him right up until the time he invaded Kuwait. He's done nothing more iniquitous since then. We could deal with him then.
He's rejected this proposal. You're not making this for the first time. He's rejected more modest proposals.
Well,
actually, he has rejected these proposals. The United States has never seriously put forward a proposal which would call for the lifting of sanctions in exchange for a return of inspectors. The United States, every proposal put forward by both the Clinton administration and currently the Bush administration holds that Iraq's economy will continue to be held hostage by the United Nations even once a finding of compliance with its disarmament obligation has been sent.
Mm. Scott Ritter, Richard Pearl, Jack Beatty, stand by. A lot of callers want to get in here. Is the U.S. finally getting serious, or is it getting punch drunk on war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
I want to thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I would, first of all, I'd say I sign on to the war on terror fully. And that my question, I also support what Mr. Pearl's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pose to the other people that you have on tonight the following question. What is the risk of not acting against Saddam? And I would say that risk is clearly, from my point of view, the risk of the World Trade Centers. And the reason I say that is because I believe that the lessons that were learned when our Marines were killed in Lebanon and the embassy bombings that occurred in Kenya and elsewhere was that we had a soft underbelly, that we had no ability to fight against terrorism, and that it led directly to the World Trade Center bombing.
Eric, do you have any concern that an attack on Iraq could turn the region more angrily against the United States?
No. I believe that those fears, as Mr. Pearl stated,
mm-hmm.
were indicated in Afghanistan before it occurred, all the risks of what would happen. In fact, what happened before we attacked Afghanistan was that there was great cheering among radicals in the Arab world to the fact that we wouldn't act. And there were demonstrations in the street. Our actions in Afghanistan quieted that dissent, particularly in Pakistan and in other locations around the world.
We got the point, and we thank you for it, Eric. Thanks very much for calling. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I guess I would have to side with much of what Jack has been saying, and that is, you know, if you go back to the original war on terrorism, the big question that was being asked is why were we losing the propaganda war with the Muslims? And I think what's not going to be lost on the Muslim world will be this notion that on the one hand we talk about freedom and democracy, and on the other hand we're going and applying daisy cutters. You know, I guess we've used them in Afghanistan. We could use them in Iraq. And
but Imran, Saddam Hussein is hardly a proponent of freedom and democracy.
No. But the point that I'm making is that while America holds itself out as being for that, what's going to be seen in the Muslim world, as Jack had said, is that here is America basically bombing another country and basically wreaking havoc in those people. And
could it be seen as a liberation movement by the United States? Saddam is a dictator.
Well, you know, it's like a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. It's like if you go ahead and you depose them, then, you know, there's going to be those people who will surely feel that here we go, here's American imperialism. If and on the other side, if you do carry this out, you're going to see people who are going to say, see, here we go. Here's another instance of America acting as, you know, world, as Noam Chomsky says. The other point I wanted to make is that I'm really surprised at Richard Pearl's statement that about the gloom and doomsayers. He said he brought reference to the Gulf War. And, you know, I was going to say that, well, one of the direct results of the World Trade Center was the Gulf War, because if you listen to the rhetoric of Osama bin Laden, one of his major grievances is the presence of U.S. Soldiers on Holy Land. Which
you mean you're saying the Gulf War led, after a time, to the World Trade Center bombing? You're drawing a connection there.
Well, the connection I'm making is that if you look at Osama bin Laden's rhetoric, right, one of his axes to grind is U.S. presence on Saudi soil. And
that's number one.
Result. Yeah, but that was a direct result of the Gulf War.
Imran, you've given us a lot. Let me turn to Richard Pearl. Richard Pearl, what about that? I want to go back to this issue that has been raised by callers and by Jack and Scott about the view of the United States by the Muslim world already. Do you think that victory in Iraq, whatever that means, would really solve that, or could we be turning a whole region, possibly a whole religion, against the U.S., and what would the price of that be?
Well,
you just posed the question yourself, and you didn't get an answer. Let me take a shot at
Please.
It. And you referred to the liberation of Iraq. I believe that it would unquestionably be the liberation of Iraq, that people all over Iraq would be dancing in the streets if Saddam were deposed. And far from turning the Arab world against us, I believe that we would be seen as having liberated that country from a miserable tyranny.
But can you imagine?
It's demeaning to Arabs to suggest that they are all on the side of Saddam Hussein, who is one of the most evil leaders of the 20th century.
And certainly we're not suggesting that. We know there's a lot of disenchantment there, but at the same time, we all know what Al Jazeera is beaming around the Arab world, the Islamic world. Can you imagine the pictures of bombs falling all over Iraq, of Israeli tanks in the West Bank? What makes you so sure that we don't produce a kind of paroxysm of rejection of the United States and the West that leads to more terror?
Because I think everything depends on the outcome. And if the outcome is that there is a decent government in Iraq, and the people of Iraq, for the first time since Saddam came to power, are rid of the burden of a brutal dictatorship, that's going to have an impact.
Scott Ritter, is it all about the outcome? If we win, if we oust Saddam Hussein successfully, will we be beloved or at least respected?
No. Look, people,
how can you say no so lightly? It would be a big step.
Criticism of the gloom and doom sayers about Afghanistan. Let's understand that Afghanistan is not a fait accompli. Afghanistan, the future of Hamid Karzai's government is not assured. Afghanistan has fractured into major competing warlords. There's a real danger of civil war. So I think we have to understand that you cannot talk about the Afghanistan model and then apply it to Iraq. We have been warned by senior Kurdish leaders, Masoud Barzani and Mr. Talabani, to stay out, that if we move in, that there will not be the kind of support Mr. Pearl envisions. We have been warned by Mr. al-Hakim, the Shia cleric operating out of Iran in opposition to Saddam Hussein, not to invade because the people of Iraq will rally around Iraq in defense of Iraq.
But, of course, there are other Iraqis saying, go in, we'll help you.
No, this is Ahmed Chalabi.
I'm saying there are other, yes.
He is not an indigenous Iraqi. He is an outsider, and almost all of the opposition are composed of outsiders. If we go into Iraq, let's make it understood, we will win militarily. Iraq can never stand on the field of battle with America's military might. But we will not be able to install a U.S. hand-picked government that has any future. And without this, central authority in Baghdad will collapse, along with it Baghdad, along with it the regime. That is a reality that is recognized by almost everybody except a handful of insiders in Washington, D.C.
There's so much to talk about here. Richard Pearl, we know your time is tight, but can you stay with us for a couple of minutes beyond this break?
Sure.
Thank you so much. We're talking tonight with Richard Pearl, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 81 to 87, Scott Ritter, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector and Iraq, and our own news analyst, Jack Beattie. The subject is, should the United States go into Iraq to take out Saddam Hussein? Would removing Saddam bring more or less stability to the Middle East? Does invading Iraq mean a setback for terror or Osama bin Laden's dream come true? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom.
ARC.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Washington is girding for war with Iraq, girding for an effort to take out Saddam Hussein. Is it time to go after Saddam Hussein? Is it time to send the U.S. military into Iraq? Would invasion remove a threat or fuel a greater war? And does the blazing conflict in Israel make it more important to take on Saddam or important to keep cool? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Richard Pearl. He's former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and with Scott Ritter, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector in Iraq. Richard Pearl, I want to ask you, is there an ideological battle going on here? We read or read last week in Cy Hirsch's article in The New Yorker about an awful lot of debate in Washington about the how to pursue this goal, if in fact the U.S. goes in. You've written that George Bush's speech after September 11th, where he said, we will make no distinction between terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them. You said this is a big statement, like Ronald Reagan's painting of the Soviet Union or labeling the Soviet Soviet Union is the evil empire. This is a major line in the sand. This is a major strategic statement for the U.S. And you've said that if the war is narrowed, the war on terror is narrowed to exclude Saddam, then this, as you say, courageous policy will be sapped of its great and vital strength. It sounds like there's an ideological battle on here as well.
Well, there's a battle certainly to discourage states from offering sanctuary to terrorists. Because if they go on doing so, we will be forced to defend ourselves at our borders, and we're an open society. I don't believe we can do that effectively.
But if you follow the dominoes here, we now have military commitments in a number of new areas around the world. We're contemplating more. We're talking over this just this last weekend about lowering the bar on the tactical use of nuclear weapons. Do we, let's say in Iraq, by going to the military approach instead of a very vigorous containment effort, is this part of a more general picture of the United States buying into a military response to terrorism, and is that a sufficient response?
If we allow states to offer sanctuary to terrorists, the number of terrorists that reach our shores, our open society, will be more than we can handle, and there will be other incidents like the World Trade Center. So we've got to discourage governments from lending support to terrorists. Now, how do you do that? One way you do it is by making the cost so high that most of the governments that do this will voluntarily decide to get out of the support of terrorism business.
Are you referring to a nuclear threat in that high cost?
No, not at all. I'm referring to the fact that there has been no cost until now. The Taliban regime paid nothing for its support of Osama bin Laden until after the fact. Now, my guess is that the Taliban, if they had to do it over again, might decide they wouldn't welcome Osama bin Laden. We need to persuade a number of other countries, 8 or 10 of them, that they should get out of the terrorism business. And the destruction of the Taliban, followed by the removal of Saddam Hussein, will be a very powerful lesson that if you support terrorism, if you chase weapons of mass destruction, you are going to encounter the United States. And so we don't have to go to war with all of these countries, but we have to make the price sufficiently high so that the others choose to get out of this business.
Scott Ritter, Richard Pearl suggests if we don't make Baghdad Exhibit A and take down Saddam Hussein, we're going to have hordes of terrorists coming across the borders.
Well, first of all, I support what Richard Pearl says about making it clear that there will be no safe haven for terrorism. I think this is an absolute in the war on terror. But we have to be careful with our definition of terror. You know, the international community, I think, is united in not only condemnation of the events of September 11th, but the concept that the United States, under Article 51 of the UN Charter, can invoke its legitimate right to self-defense to go after those who perpetrated that attack. Saddam Hussein clearly is not in that company. So now we have to ask ourselves why people are trying to introduce him as part of this company. And I again bring up the argument
about
weapons.
Scott, you don't deny that he gives sanctuary to terrorists, do you?
Well, first of all, he gives sanctuary. You know, it's not just what I have to say. It's what the State Department and the CIA says. They say since 1993, there is no evidence that Saddam Hussein has supported or participated in anti-American terrorism.
Well, they're wrong about that.
Well, I happen to like to side on the side of the experts in the State Department and the CIA. Saddam Hussein does work with a anti-Iranian
Is Abu Nidal living in Baghdad?
Abu Nidal is living in Baghdad, and I think he's been neutralized for the last two decades. So, you know, let's stick with the facts. The facts are that Iraq cannot be said with all certainty, with the kind of absolute certainty that is required to justify the use of American military power to be in possession of weapons of mass destruction.
Scott Ritter, let me ask you,
Hamza, and I have to just say this, I investigated the Iraqi nuclear weapons program, and I've interviewed everybody involved in the weaponization of nuclear weapons in Iraq, from the head, Dr. Jafar Diyal-Jafar, down to the lowliest man. Hamza was never one of these. He was not part of the program. He's a fraud, and I'm sort of embarrassed that somebody of Mr. Pearl's stature would be citing him as justification.
Scott Ritter, I want to ask you then, Richard Butler, your I guess, erstwhile colleague in the UN inspection effort, has come out in favor of a tough line on Saddam, even taking Saddam out. Why the difference between you two? Your experiences would seem to an outsider to have been similar.
Well, my experience with compared to Richard Butler's differs in one major aspect. I was involved from 1991 to 1998. Richard Butler came in the middle of 1997. So his experience in terms of chronology is very limited. And I would say that Richard Butler came in his defense, in a very difficult period where the question wasn't so much disarming Iraq, but rather the political process of gaining access to sensitive sites inside Iraq, a process which was obstructed and rejected by the Iraqis. They fought tooth and nail to keep us out of presidential palaces, security institutions.
But that's just what has people worried, isn't it?
Well, again, let's go back to the record. UNSCOM, when we attempted to get into these security installations, never, ever felt there were weapons of mass destruction in these facilities. We were searching for documents, and I think even Richard Pearl will recognize that a document by itself is not a weapon of mass destruction.
Scott Ritter, stand by, and Richard Pearl as well. I want to bring callers in here. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. I want to make a point quite different from what your guests have stated.
All right.
And that is that as a person of color, I say there is no war on terrorism, because if there's no war on racism, there is no war on terrorism. Also, as a Latino of Cuban descent, I'm well aware of United States terrorism against Cuba and United States support for Cuban terrorists who are living in Miami and well off, well on the hog. Now, let me get to my point, which is this. Using the same argument that Mr. Pearl makes, why not call for a preemptive attack against the United States? The United States is using weapons of mass destruction, thermobaric bombs, the Daisy Cutter, cluster bombs, depleted uranium. The United States has failed to obey international treaties or to come in line with the international consensus regarding landmines, regarding the International Criminal Court, mm-hmm. and numerous international treaties.
Steve, we've got your angle, and we see the American arsenal there. Jack Beatty, let me turn to you on this one. Steve is not ready to just sit in the United States and pass judgment on the rest of the world without looking in our own cupboard first. And he says, why are we different? I mean, this is a radical critique.
Well, it's the way a lot of people see us, and that's a political fact. And the question is, in politics, in international politics, how do you affect perceptions of that we know to be erroneous? Because I don't believe this is true. I don't think we are a menace to the world. I think we're a defender of freedom in the world. How do we get that message across, and how important is that to our future security? I say it's vital to our future security. So then the question is, how do you act to challenge the view that he just gave, which I think is a fair sample of what you'd find in lots of the other part of the world, that we're a kind of, you mm-hmm. know, nascent bully, just aching to go out and use our military.
I think we lost Jack for a second there, but let's turn back to the line. So many callers here. Benyam is on the line. Welcome, Benyam.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. What gives the United States the legal right to invade a sovereign territory? We're speaking about it as if, you know, nonchalantly, yet we're speaking about when we say Saddam, very well mm-hmm. and good, he's a tyrant, hated probably more by his own people than by any U.S. citizen. Yet the United States government for the past 20 years has been his best friend, and this is at a time when he was gassing the Kurds.
Well, certainly not for the last 10 years, but we take your point. Let me put it to Richard Pearl. Richard Pearl, how about the legal basis for a military action against Iraq?
It's Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which doesn't confer the right, but merely recognizes the right of self-defense. We can wait. We can wait and hope that Saddam takes no action against us. But we waited too long in the case of September 11. We could have acted against the Osama bin Laden and the Taliban long before September 11. We had plenty of reason to do so. And the Clinton administration, and even into the Bush administration, the decision was made to wait. And we waited too long, and we have too many fatalities. The next time, if it's a weapon of mass destruction, when it's all over, people will be saying, why did we wait so long?
You can just hear how this must play and play powerfully in the Bush White House. Kim is on the line. Welcome, Kim. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
I think one of the things, I really like the United States being the preserver of freedom and everything, but I think we need to take a look at one of the things that's gotten us into real hot water in this region, and that's the oil question.
How so, Kim? How so? I mean, well, we depend on it, but what else?
Well, there, you know, all the pipelines that we've been trying to build through Afghanistan, through Iran, and from the Central Asian republics.
So are you saying, are you a native oil-only guy? You don't want U.S. To be dependent on Middle East oil? Is that your point?
No, I'm not saying that, but I think we really need to take a look at the multinational corporations that are driving this. I mean, look who's over there. We've got Dick Cheney and George Bush, and we know what their heritage is and what their you know, business interests are. And, you know, it's all well and good to say we want to bring freedom to Iraq, but I think there are ulterior motives going on there.
But if Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, what would it matter if all his oil went to Europe instead of the United States? Wouldn't that still be a threat, Kim?
I don't understand your question. I mean, the thing is, we all have, as some of your other callers have pointed out, we have weapons of mass destruction. There's an inequality all around. And I think, just picking Saddam Hussein out as a scapegoat and as the poster child of the hour is not the answer.
Kim, we've got your point. But Scott Ritter, would you call Saddam Hussein a scapegoat here? You've got intimate experience there. Isn't there a little bit more to be worried about than that?
Well, look, Saddam Hussein has one of the most brutal records in modern history. I will never, ever position myself as an apologist for his regime. He's a despicable, brutal dictator who has committed horrific crimes, not only against his own people, but against the region. And I would hope that there is a time and place when he can be hauled before a court of international justice and held accountable for it.
Then can inspections work as an alternative to war?
I absolutely. Again, you have to ask yourself, what is the ultimate objective? If the ultimate objective is the elimination or reduction or reducing the threat, the possible threat posed by Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, weapons inspections are extremely effective. But I would propose to you that it's not about weapons of mass destruction and that it never has been since 1991, because successive presidential administrations have stated that economic sanctions, which are linked to Iraq's disarmament obligation, will not be lifted until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power, regardless of Iraq's disarmament compliance.
So you're saying it's a blood feud and they want Saddam Hussein out.
Mm-hmm. The problem is Saddam, and if the problem is Saddam not linked to his weapons of mass destruction, it means that the problem isn't Saddam as a national security threat, but rather Saddam as a domestic political problem.
Richard Pearl, we've just got 20 seconds left. Last word goes to you.
Well, I don't want to repeat myself. The question is, can we afford to wait? And I think if we wait too late, the costs are so horrendous that the risks involved in removing him from office, to say nothing of the benefits for the people of Iraq, justify that action.
When will we go to war?
Well, I don't know that we will go to war as such. I think we've got to start by helping the opposition liberate their country.
Richard Pearl, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 81 to 87, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
All the best.
And Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, 10 seconds. Your thoughts?
Well, Sir Michael Howard, the British military thinker, says that a war against Iraq would be the equivalent of a nuclear exchange in the Cold War.
That's big. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.